the devil is not Steve across the table from me, or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, hello there, and welcome to the Bible Geeks Weekly Podcast. This is episode 70. I'm Brian Sheely.
I'm Ryan Joy.
And thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in. On today's episode, we are getting into probably everyone's favorite section of Scripture. Two of our Bible bracket winning chapters are here in this section of Scripture here in week 28.
Including the grand champion of them all.
Exactly. Matthew 6 and Matthew 7. And so we're in Matthew chapters 4 through 8 this week in our reading. And it is hard to pick what we want to talk about on this episode, isn't it?
It's a very rich couple of chapters. So we were not devoid of material to work with.
Yeah, sometimes we get into it and it's like, what are we going to even talk about? And then here it's like, what are we not going to talk about? It's a good problem to have, I guess.
Yeah, great stuff. I guess we should just jump right into it.
Yeah, we're gonna probably go long on this one, so let's dive right in. As we always do, finding Jesus here in week 28 of the End of the Book Bible Reading Program. We're in Matthew chapters 4 through 8. So where do you find Jesus here in these chapters? Easy to find him. He's everywhere, really.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting something he said about himself in the sermon in Matthew 5, verse 17. He said, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And it's interesting here, he's, I think, beginning the body of the sermon, and in fact, I think there's sort of bookends, and I'm going to show the other end of that bookend, the end of the body of the sermon in my scripture du jour. But he uses this term, the law and the prophets, here. He uses it again in Matthew 7. And he's about to get into this extended discussion of what you've heard before, how people have understood the Old Testament, and what he's about to tell them. And some of them, he just completely alters or steps beyond what the Old Testament said, and some of them he's just addressing what people have thought about it. But what I take from this in this context is, just like we keep reading these statements that Jesus fulfills various texts in the Old Testament with his life, in context, I think this says Jesus is fulfilling the Old Testament teaching in his teaching as well. So as a teacher, he's showing us the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And of course, Matthew loves that phrase, that he fulfilled, he brought to completion, he filled up all of the meaning of these Old Testament passages, and in fact, the whole Old Testament story itself in himself. It was all pointing to him. And now he's going to show us what all of those Old Testament laws, all the moral teaching and instruction that Moses and the prophets brought were leading towards. And he gives these six antitheses, these, you heard it said, but I say to you. Yeah. And man, these are challenging ideas. It's like there were training wheels on these laws in Moses' teaching, but when Jesus comes, it's full throttle. It's all the way challenging ideas. It's like I recently heard Jerry Seinfeld talking about the difference between single people and married people. And he was saying, you know, I look at a single guy and it's like, I know you're trying to figure it out, but you're still playing with Nerf guns and we've got live ammo over here. And it's kind of that same idea that Jesus is bringing us to this really challenging way to live. But this is, as he starts out saying, this is the better way. This is the blessed way.
I can't help but think about that old Paul Harvey radio program, The Rest of the Story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's kind of what he's doing here. He's like, he goes through the whole explanation of all the things that they know. And now you know the rest of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
And he himself is the rest of the story. This was all leading to him and leading to his teaching. And like you said, in those six points that he brings up about the old law here in just a little bit, I mean, these are very probably mind-blowing things for him to bring up for them. And it's not going to be easy for them to have this shift in their mindset, but it's something that has been built into the law all along, that it would change and really be taken to the next level, and its fulfillment really here in Jesus' life and in his teaching.
Yeah, and I love that you use the word mindset, because that's really what he's addressing here. He's getting to the root of these problems, and adultery is a problem. Let's go all the way to the root of it. Mm-hmm. And there's so much evil in the world. If we can deal with the lusting and the coveting and the wanting things as a possession and people as a possession, and to have what is not ours to have, you know, and hate and anger, and really recognizing the power and beauty of the marriage covenant as God intended. And all of these things are really powerful guideposts that show us what a good life, the right life, looks like. And I just think, as we're looking for Jesus here, we can see that he's not trying to take away the Old Testament. He doesn't invalidate the authority of the Old Testament. Rather, he strengthens the authority of the Old Testament by saying, all of that was about me, and I'm going to show you how important all of those teachings are that point to me. So where did you find Jesus in these chapters?
Well, I found Jesus in the wilderness here in Matthew chapter 4. I really latched on to something and this question that I could not shake as I was reading this. In Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." And the story from that point goes on, and Jesus would be tempted 3 times by the devil. But here in the beginning, Jesus went into the wilderness knowing full well that he was going to be tempted by the devil. Mm-hmm. Why on earth would he put himself in a position of being susceptible to weakness? Why? If I was going to be tempted and I knew I was going to be tempted, we kind of talked about it a few episodes ago, you know, I might pull the Home Alone and the Kevin McAllister, and I might go and try to shore up all my defenses and, you know, put myself in the best possible position to defend myself. But what does Jesus do?
Yeah, and he prays this week, "Lead us not into temptation."
Exactly.
But there's something, it's a great question. I'm interested in what you have to say about it.
So what I don't understand is why he does this. But then I came back to something that we talked about last week, where we see Jesus in the manger. We see his humanity, and we spent a good bit of time talking about that last week. Why is Jesus relatable to me? Well, because he's a human. And here, you know, it says that he was hungry. He was brought to a point where he was weak and he was in need. As Jesus stands before the devil and confronts him 3 times with these temptations, Jesus was not at his most powerful. He was probably at his weakest. I mean, fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, that's intense. And I've never fasted for that long, but I can only imagine what he was going through. And so if Jesus, at his weakest, maybe at this point, was able to stand against the devil 3 times, then I should be able to do that too. You know, I'm certainly not as weak as Jesus was, physically speaking, in my life when I have to stand against the devil. And if he could do it at his lowest moment, it's almost like the fighter who is going into battle with one arm tied behind his back. And that's kind of what Jesus is showing us here. I'm going to bring myself low so that when I face these things, you will be able to relate to me, not because I'm the Son of God, but because I'm hungry.
That's really good. The fighter who ties his arm behind his back, one arm behind his back, and says, "Okay, I'm going to show you this can be done, even at the lowest, most challenging place in humanity." And, you know, back in chapter 3, whenever he was talking about why he needed to be baptized, he said, "Let's do this to fulfill all righteousness." And I wonder if that kind of idea plays into this. He's showing us what it means to live this life of human righteousness. And he's also, I think we maybe have talked about this before, I don't remember, he's also kind of retracing in an archetypal way, retracing the steps of Israel as the great human, but also the great Israelite. You know, he goes through the water in baptism. He goes into the wilderness, not for 40 years, but for 40 days. He's tested with hunger and with all the things, really, that they were tested by. And he passes the test. And then we see him go up on the mountain, as we've been talking about, and teaches. So there's this sense of him finally getting it right, like maybe Israel should have, and like we all should. And I really like that idea that you're saying of him bringing himself to the weakest point and putting himself really in the lion's mouth and saying, can you get me? and then escaping and showing us his victory there.
Well, speaking of a lion, as we transition into our next segment, which is scripture du jour.
What is the soup du jour?
It's the soup of the day.
That sounds good. I'll have that.
So we're in Matthew 7, and we're going to grab something out of Matthew 7 that we found to be important. But I do want to point us backward to episode 60, when in our Bible bracket conversation, we went back to Matthew chapter 6, which is obviously the passage here that we read yesterday. And that episode, Crocodile and a Lion, which is the title, was all about really focusing on this chapter in one of the segments there. So put that conversation together with this one, and you have probably a pretty good understanding of these two chapters of Jesus' great sermon. So what do you get from this chapter in Matthew 7 that really stands out at you?
I went to Matthew 7:12 and the golden rule. And I mentioned earlier that here he brings in again the law and the prophets. And so that phrase seems to mark, I think, the beginning and end. The technical word is an inclusio, or kind of bookends is how I describe it, as showing the heart of the sermon. And he's about to say his invitation, so to speak, his challenge, which is about doing these things. And he's going to throw down a bunch of pictures of the choice we have. But before he does, he sums up all of the law and the prophets, and in a way, all of his teaching in this simple rule that we've all heard. We all heard when we were little, and yet it never ceases to amaze me whenever I really start reflecting on it, how difficult it is to do. It's about practicing this thing, as he's about to say. And so he says, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So I did a lesson, which I'll put in the show notes, on this rule. And I've been doing this series I call Game Changers, where I take one simple, usually very familiar practice or commandment of Jesus, and I try to just show how if you just do this one thing, how powerful and how much of an impact it can have on your life in so many areas. But one of the things I thought about is the different rules that we live by. And if this is the golden rule, the Bible doesn't say that, but it's been called that for a long time. If this is the golden rule, I talked about the iron rule and the bronze rule. And so we could find the iron rule, the rule that a lot of people live by, back in Judges 15, verses 10 and 11, where Samson and the Philistines both talk about what they did, and they both say, I just did to them what they did to me. And that's how a lot of people live. But that is not the rule of Jesus, of course.
I'm going to call it the social media rule. That's what it sounds like.
That does sound exactly like it. They were following Judges 15, 10 to 11 to the letter. And then there's the bronze rule, as I called it, which is a moral teaching, kind of a version of the golden rule, but a lesser version that was popularized in different ways. There was a teacher named Hillel the Elder that reportedly was approached by a Gentile who wanted to know what it looked like to become a follower of Judaism. And he said, if you can teach me while I stand on one leg the law and what I need to know, then I'll follow, I'll convert to Judaism. And he says, Hillel the Elder says to him, do not do to others what is hateful to you. The rest is just commentary. And so there is that version. And so Jesus wasn't the only one who said something like this, but there's something very distinctive in what Jesus is saying here. And you can see it throughout the Sermon on the Mount, this idea of doing good to even enemies. Somebody does something bad to you and you actually don't just avoid hitting them back if they hit you. You actually do something kind for them. Mm-hmm. You actually pray for your enemies. You actually bless them. And so it's the difference between, you know, not taking someone else's cookie versus giving someone a cookie when you have one, or breaking off half of your cookie and giving it to you. I mean, that's a very simple little version of it, but it's, I mean, a good cookie, come on. Yeah. I mean, that's
hard to beat.
That's the cookie rule. But the golden rule basically is this idea of thinking about what would be good for someone else. If you were them, what would you want you to do to them? And so it's, instead of just not doing harm, it's about helping everyone. And I know this is a basic rule and it's something that hopefully all of us have thought about, but I think this is really challenging. It's very hard to measure, and therefore it always has us kind of introspectively thinking and considering our ways. And then it has us, I think, forced to get out of our self-involved bubble and think about what's happening in someone else's mind. It's like a law of what if. It's not about giving them exactly what I want, which is the classic husband gift-buying blunder, you know? Like, I want this, so I'm going to buy that for my wife, you know? Look, honey, I got you a new snowblower or whatever, you know? But what if I were them, what would I want? And trying to really understand what that is. And what do they need? And what would bless them? You know, going beyond just what do they want? Because sometimes maybe you want something that isn't best for you, but really trying to serve people and give them that which would bless them, and think about their world a little bit. And so it's fostering empathy and creating this new connection, a bridge from you out of yourself to the world. And I think that's where the power of this golden rule really lies.
Yeah, real-time follow-up. Our brother Jeff in the live stream just mentioned that he, and I think a lot of us probably do, we think about this verse, this golden rule, often in terms of the world at large, but it also applies, like you said, to the people who are closest to us. And sometimes those are the people who are the hardest for us to apply this to.
That is so true, and it's a great point, and it is really something that has to be practiced in the home and in your everyday small interactions if you're ever going to actually start living it. And so, yeah, the home, I think your kids or your parents, your siblings, if you're younger, you know, your wife, of course, or husband, the people that you're interacting with on a daily basis in that most intimate setting where you might feel like you can just think beyond some of those things. I put a few thoughts in the lesson as far as specific challenges whenever I was thinking about this before, kind of very specifically. I brought up that point that Jeff brought up. The more you know about someone, the better we should be at practicing the golden rule. And yet sometimes courtesy can get lost in politeness. And so a few questions here. How do you want people to resolve conflicts with you? You know, whenever you have a conflict, someone has done something against you or irritated you. Well, how would I want them to approach me if I were the one?
Yep.
You know, what do you want people to assume about you? Because you're looking out at other people and assuming things about them. What would you want them to assume about you? Or how do you want people to talk about you? Talk that way about other people. So you can see how this just in a million ways starts to have its fingers going outward into a million different applications. But
yeah,
that's what I kind of grabbed onto here in this in chapter 7.
So I'm going to fast forward to the end of the chapter here. Not quite the very end, but the last thing Jesus says here in this great sermon here in Matthew chapter 7, verse 24 and 25. He closes this whole thing out really with this familiar story that we probably have been hearing since we were kids. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. Then he talks about the foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rains fell, and the floods came, the winds blew, beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. We all probably sang this song growing up as kids in our Bible class.
I kept wanting to say, and the house went splat.
It did. It did, in fact. It was a great splat, which is...
It was a great splat.
But I wonder, you know, if our familiarity with this story kind of helps it lose its meaning in some way. But do you drive through an expensive neighborhood admiring all of the houses? And what is it that you look at? Like when you're driving around and you're taking a road trip and you're going through this fancy neighborhood, what do you notice when you see these expensive houses that you're driving through? You know, are you impressed by the architecture or the landscaping or the size of the front door? You know, how many cars they can fit in their garage? There's a couple of houses in our neighborhood that I ride my scooter by, you know, every now and again. And they're like mansions with gates and ponds and ducks and, you know, amazing houses. But I notice the things that are on the outside of the house or on the facade of the house. But when was the last time you ever stopped to think, I wonder what the foundation of that house looks like? And we don't think about the foundation. We think about the structure. We think about all of the external adornments and all of the fanciness that we can see on the outside. But you never stop and really think, like, is that house built on a stable foundation? And Jesus is going back as he closes out this great sermon, throwing back to all the things that he said previously. If you hear these words of mine and do them, then you are on a stable foundation and you will not fall. Like, it doesn't really matter what people can see on the outside or what they can view of our life. You know, they might see all kinds of amazing things and great accomplishments, and they might be really impressed by what we do and what we've said and all the work that we've done. But if at the end of the day, our foundation really isn't on Jesus, then it doesn't really matter what we've built and what we've put together.
Yeah, and the foundation, what he says is the foundation is doing his words. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like that song doesn't quite explain that.
Yes.
It's a great song. I love that song.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't explain that the foundation is in the doing. You know, and Paul does talk about our foundation being Jesus, or he talks elsewhere about the foundation being the apostles and prophets and Jesus the cornerstone. Mm-hmm. But here, building on a solid foundation is doing these things. Yeah. It's about not just hearing them, not just understanding them, not just believing them, but living as if we believe them and as if this is the only way to live a solid, stable life. And I heard, I'm still reading that book I mentioned last week, The Divine Conspiracy, and he has this paragraph where he talks about, what if you drove by a church sign and it said something like, we teach people how to do everything that the Lord has said. Mm-hmm. We teach people how to do it. And you might think, well, you know, that makes sense. That's the Great Commission, part of the Great Commission, teach them to do all that. But then you might really have some pause as you think about what that is going to mean. You know, he talks about having a course on how to bless those who curse you. We're going to teach you how to actually do this. You know, having a course on all these very basic, difficult things that is about living it, not just about how to understand the Trinity and how to understand all of the scenarios for divorce and remarriage, or, you know, all these different ideas that can affect our practice and be very important, and doctrinally could be very important. But getting beyond just understanding and believing, training people on how to do the absolute basic aspects, not easy, but the fundamental aspects of what it means to live a Christ-like life. To live the golden rule, to live these things that you're talking about. So I really appreciate that emphasis on how he closes. It's about doing.
All right. So let's get into our last and final segment, last and final.
Both.
Which is deep thoughts.
And now Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy.
And so we probably got a lot of deep thoughts here on the Sermon on the Mount. We could probably spend a lot more time than we're going to. But where in this great sermon of Jesus do you find something really deep and just impactful for your life.
Went a moment ago to the closing words of the sermon, so I will just talk for a minute about the first three words of the sermon.
This really is the bookends episode here.
This really is. So he starts with these three words, blessed are the.
Wow.
And I think there's something profound already in those, just how he opens his mouth and speaks, blessed are the, and then of course he gives his list, the Beatitudes there, and these aren't the only Beatitudes he gives. He often talks about blessed ones, and what he's really doing is explaining a different way to live. And I think it's noteworthy, first of all, that he's not giving a command here.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, you should be a peacemaker, you should be meek. As he often does, he's giving a truth.
Yep.
Take it or leave it, I'm going to tell you the way things are. Blessed are the meek, and there's a reason for that. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, and let me tell you why. And what he's telling them here about the way things are is the blessed way to live. And this is blessed, of course, in view of eternity, there is a blessedness. And I think there is a here and now kind of blessedness in it too, but certainly it would be hard to understand this really without understanding that kind of broader perspective. Mm-hmm. But really, he's all of these Beatitudes, and the tenor of the whole sermon is set by these Beatitudes, in that Jesus is telling us how our usual assumptions about the best life are leading us astray.
Yeah.
And we need to just, right from the beginning, as he opens his mouth for his first discourse here in Matthew, he's going to be telling us, here's the way to happiness. Here's the way to maybe more, or more accurately than just happiness, because that word gets a little brittle and weak in our modern way of thinking. Here's the way to a life that God has shown favor to, and shown favor in many rich and abundant ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's nothing greater than experiencing God's favor. And that's really what the blessed life looks like. And so I just think that, you know, you don't have to go very far into this sermon to find a deep thought. And I just stopped right there and truncated the first verse of Jesus' statement and noticed how amazing it is what he's doing by telling us the blessed way to live. And it really is the good life from a different perspective, the best life that he's going to show us. And we need to learn to actually believe in the way we really live. This is the best way.
Yeah. And on paper, what Jesus says here should just be rejected outright. You know, I mean, it's completely outside of what any of us would define as the best life. I mean, even, you know, very religious people have stood up on huge stages in front of thousands of people and talked to them about how the best life looks like something. You know, fill in the blank, whatever description they want to use. But very rarely does the best life look like the next word that you skipped over here, poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Blessed are the poor in spirit. I mean, that is not what I think of when I think of the best life. Those who mourn, you know, the meek, those who hunger. And he just goes on in his list, you know, in verse 11, blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil things about you. That does not look like the best life if you're missing the connection that he has with eternity. And like you said, I think, which is really important, is that all of these really point to something in the future. You know, there's a future tense promise that will happen when we embody these characteristics. You know, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and they shall be comforted. They shall inherit the earth. And that's the hopefulness that we look forward to. But on the surface of it, it's really not something we generally would aspire to without Jesus' encouragement.
You know, as a preacher, you're told to have an attention-getting opener. Jesus, I think, had some people sitting up, and certainly should have us paying attention once we get to this point.
Yeah.
So with that setup, what is your deep thought?
Yeah, so I had to pick out my probably most challenged instruction here. And I think it's important as we start looking through what Jesus says here in the Sermon on the Mount to really settle into where we have the most difficulty with. And there are plenty of places here where I just scratch my head and say, how on earth could I ever do this? And in Matthew 5, verses 38 through 42, Jesus says something that I wrestle with a lot. And he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him your other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. And those examples that he gives at the end there are important to help illustrate the point that he's really trying to make, which is about do not resist the one who is evil. And it seems to me, you know, that he's talking about this retaliation idea. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That really is in the Bible. That is definitely in the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 24, you know, the people were given instruction on what to do when somebody blasphemes the name of God, or when somebody kills one of your animals, or when somebody bruises you or burns you or does something evil to you. You're supposed to give to them the punishment that they gave to you in return. And that was the old law's way of dealing with what people did. And Jesus then goes beyond that, beyond this retaliation. And he tells us now, don't resist the one who's evil. And if there's anything that Jesus says here that's challenging for me to really just accept and embrace, it's not resisting one who is evil. And I think the reason why that is, at least for me, is that it's almost like I'm giving up, or that I'm just rolling over and I'm allowing evil people to just take over and take advantage of me. But I'm still fighting a battle. And I think it's important for us to recognize that it takes probably more strength to not resist the one who's evil than it does to resist them. And I think of something like Romans 12, verse 21, overcoming evil with good. There's still a battle going on, even though my opponent, my enemy, may never know that I'm fighting that battle. You know, I'm fighting a battle between good and evil, and I'm going to overcome evil with good, but it's not something that I naturally come to. I want to slap them back. I want to take away something from them. I want to stand up and resist them and say, no, I'm not going to be taken advantage of and go with you an extra mile.
The iron rule.
Yeah, exactly. The cookie rule.
The cookie rule. I heard it said once, and it's always stuck with me, what you resist persists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really powerful truth that is underlying some of this. You know, whenever you push back against something, it's like then the other person feels like they need to push back that much harder.
Yeah.
And you just, it's like the laws of thermodynamics from a moral relational standpoint, you know, that sense of equal and opposite reaction where you can't overcome evil with evil and you can't win that way.
Right.
But rather, if you choose love, if you choose to do the unthinkable thing and go beyond just not retaliating, you're actually offering something up more. Somebody's thought they had the power whenever this Roman soldier forced you to go with them 1 mile, as they had the right in the law to do. But you say, hey, don't even worry about it. I'm just going to carry you. Where are you going? Yeah, I can carry you another mile. I'll just carry it for you.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world is happening? There's something strange about these people, you know, right. These people who turn the other cheek. And that is really powerful.
And I don't at all want to minimize the struggle that people are going through or the injustice that people are facing, especially right now in this time. But what is going to be gained by resisting and protesting and really actively fighting against all of these things? You know, what's
hashtag resisting?
What? Yeah, right. I mean, what's really going to be gained by all of that? I don't know. And am I, when I get my back up and get all angry and upset, am I really following what Jesus is telling me to do here to not resist the one who's evil? I mean, you can also take this and balance this with we're supposed to resist the devil, you know, James chapter 4, verse 7, 1 Peter 5, verse 9, definitely tells us to resist the devil and he'll flee from us. But the devil is not Steve across the table from me, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, punch Steve in the eye and say that I'm resisting the devil.
There's that belly button we were talking about.
Exactly. Poor Steve. I'm picking on him. I don't even know who Steve is, but but I mean, there's a line there, right? Because we need to resist the devil, but we can't be resisting one who's evil if we're following Jesus' words here. And so are we ever standing against an evil person, or are we ever standing against evil in general? That's a difficult balance, I think, to strike. But we need to have the wisdom and discernment to be able to strike that balance so that we're not fighting a battle with people in a way that they would look at us and say, you're a terrible person and I don't want anything to do with what you stand for. Because there have been plenty of people who profess to have a relationship with Christ who ruined their influence on people because they were angry and bitter and treated people in a way that Jesus never would have condoned, I think.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of distinctions and principles that come to play, biblical principles, as we try to figure out what we need to do, how we can not support anything wrong, how we can stand in love and commitment to what's right. And this is one of the principles that we need to fold into our thinking about this, that this thing that you're highlighting, that I almost said resistance is futile. And that's not the principle.
I almost said that here.
That resistance is not the way, that kind of resistance is not the way of Christ. That kind of, as you say, especially person to person standing and opposing and fighting, there is a different way that's actually powerful, but it's powerful through grace and love and not through force.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really interesting application also that you're making.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus obviously walked into the temple and flipped over tables. Paul obviously got in Peter's face and withstood him and told him, hey, you're messing around with the way you're treating Gentiles here. And Paul obviously held up his Roman citizenship in the book of Acts and said, look, you're treating me unfairly because I'm a Roman citizen. You know, so holding up our rights, standing up for what is right is important. But at the same time, I think what we need to walk away from this whole conversation with is, if we're doing this because of personal vendettas or these vengeful, hateful attitudes, that's never going to be the right motivation for why we're resisting sin. We have to be doing these things carefully, thoughtfully, and out of love. And if love ultimately isn't the motivation behind it, and a real deep concern for people's souls, even our enemies, if that's not why we're doing what we're doing, then we need to have a reality check and think about why we're standing up and getting so bothered by things that maybe we should just be letting go and giving people the thing we would want if we were in their shoes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jesus said this fulfills all the law, and he was pointing to this, that principle that of the second greatest commandment, right? Love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
And therefore consider what you would want. What is it that you need? And that is a really good starting point for any of these dilemmas that any modern dilemma, any ancient dilemma. If we come back to these principles, they are timeless and they really will lead us in the right way.
Yeah. I think Jesus here is setting a very high standard for us, but it is one that we can all really push toward. And nothing that he's saying here is impossible for us to attain. Nothing that he's saying here is just like, I could never do this. It's not to say that any of these things are easy.
No, that's a really good point, though, that you're saying. The idea is not, I'm going to just do a very short rant.
Okay.
If I could. I know I just interrupted you.
Let's get your soapbox. Here we go. Ready?
Here, I'm setting it up. Okay. Everybody listen. I've got my my chest puffed out. No, not really. no, I heard a very well-known preacher of a mega church down in Atlanta, talk about these statements in the Sermon on the Mount, especially some of these in Matthew chapter 5, and say that the whole point of these is to show that we can never achieve this standard, we can never do them, and therefore we need to rely on grace. Well, I mean, there's a truth in the fact that we need to rely on grace, and we all fall short of God's glory. We all have not done what we should have done and will not merit our own salvation. But that is not the point of these. Jesus is very clear at the end of his sermon when he says, here's the standard, the one who does these things. You are meant to hear these things and live them. And that means you can do it. It's going to take work. You're going to fall down sometimes, but you can do it. And I think sometimes in the way that Christianity is approached in, if I could say, popular Christianity, you know, just the way it's talked about sometimes, it sometimes sounds like it's all just about your belief and your feelings and the relationship with Jesus, not based on actually living the way he said to live, which is the basis of a relationship with Jesus. You know, I mean, that is that's fundamental to what he is going to do in response to us, according to the end of Matthew 7. Those who are doing these things, he's going to say he knows us.
Yeah, it's good.
Soapbox set aside, rant complete.
All right, and with both of us standing on level ground, let's get into the challenge for this week. And I think I've got it this week. So let's find a way to give somebody our tunic this week. You know, think about that however you want to take it. You know, I think we really all have opportunities where we can help people, where we can spend and be spent for other people. And sometimes those people may not be, in our minds, immediately deserving of that kind of gift and that kind of attention. And, you know, it's something that Jesus tells us to do here. And if there's an opportunity you have this week to look around to people who may need you to give them something and provide them with something, you know, go ahead and do that this week, as challenging as that might be.
Yeah, and that might include those who might be trying to take something away from you, even if it's just, you know, your right to express your opinion or something, you know, something little, to bring us back to the social media crazy world, you know, but you can just happily give it up and just listen and see what you can give. You know what I mean? Yep. Sometimes people are trying to take something away from you, and it might even just be emotionally take something away. And that's the whole point of that little discourse, is in those situations, our response is to offer even more.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into the Bible Geeks podcast. You can find us on our website at BibleGeeks.fm. You can find show notes for this episode in BibleGeeks.fm/70 or in your podcast player of choice. And you can get in touch with us. If you want to know how to support the show, go to BibleGeeks.fm/contact and get in touch with us. Share the show with a friend. And if there's anything you'd like to hear about on upcoming episodes, please, please, please reach out to us. We're going through our Into the Book series, but we would always love to tackle some of the questions or issues that you've got. And until next week, everyone, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
Shalom.